of the talk of gasoline. Allie, Tony Donahue alongside the story of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Donald Davidson. Again, live from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway on a Friday night. It was a chilly day today, but plenty of on-track activity where Felix Rosenquist picks up his first career NTT IndyCar Series pole. He will lead the field down with his teammate Scott Dixon tomorrow when the green flag flies just after 3:30. 239-1070, 317-239-1070, at Tony D 1070 on Twitter with your questions of a nostalgic nature. And finally, Donald, happy Friday to you. And we're here at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. No better place we'd rather be.
Well, I don't have the sun in my eyes tonight, which is normally the way that that we do it, but that's okay. It's great to be back out here.
Well, let's get right to it. We'll go to Steve on line two in Indianapolis. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hello,
hi,
Steve.
There. How are you?
Just fine, thank you.
Good. I just wanted to ask you, can you talk about the relationship of Pat Patrick and Gordon Johncock? I know they were together for at least 12 years, and they had the STP sponsorship from about 73 to 84.
Yes. In fact, I'll tell you how Johncock got the ride, but just to cover the fact that 73 was the first year, and he ended up the winner of a shortened race that many of us would rather forget, but it still was a victory for him. And then 9 years later, he won again, and actually had a really good record at the Speedway. How that came about, I don't know that Johncock and Patrick knew each other to begin with, but here was the situation in 1972, where Gary Bettenhausen had driven for Penske starting in 72, and it was a rather tempestuous season, and Gary was beginning to think that he wouldn't be renewed for the 73 and 74 season. So in the meantime, the Patrick Racing team was reorganized, and it had been Johnny Rutherford with Mike Devon as chief mechanic. And then also in the mix for this particular story is that Gordon Johncock was driving for Team McLaren as Peter Revson's teammate. But he didn't run all of the races. I think he ran six races total. So anyway, at the end of the season, Patrick Racing team completely reorganized, and George Bignotti was hired by Pat Patrick, and Swede Savage, who had driven for the Michener team, but of which Patrick was a sponsor and now taking over as an owner. It was originally Michener Petroleum with Patrick Racing sponsorship, but Patrick was now coming in to become the owner. And Patrick really liked Swede Savage, so he was part of the team. And then who to fill the other seat? Well, Bignotti and Bettenhausen talked a lot. And as I say, Gary just assumed that he was going to be released by Penske because he had still driven sprint cars, which Penske didn't want him to do. The night before the Michigan 200, Gary was at Toledo, crashed and had an injury, and it was Gordon Johncock that subbed for him. So a lot of people are not aware that Johncock drove for Penske, but it was just for that one race. So anyway, Gary's saying, let's do it, yes. And then Penske says, no, you signed a three-year deal, and we're going to exercise the option to keep you. And so Gary was really upset about it. In the meantime, Johncock had been released by McLaren, and the fact that Johnny Rutherford was no longer with the Michener Patrick team, he got hired by McLaren. I know this is probably a little difficult to follow. And so the day that Gary was here, I went to see Bignotti at the shop up behind Lafayette Square to tell him, I can't do it, they won't let me go. And so Gary went that night to the Holiday Inn Northwest, I think, which is no longer there. And here's Johncock. And so John Cox says, what's happened? Gary said, I was going to drive for Patrick and Big Noddy, but Penske won't let me go. So apparently John Cox went up to the shop the next day and got the ride. And so formed this relationship. He was, as I say, I don't know if he knew Patrick or not. They were both from Michigan, but it's possible that they didn't know each other or maybe very well. But so it went all the way up through 1985. And I know that during the previous winter, John Cox had moved to he'd moved out west to a ranch. It was the Diamond Head Ranch, I think. And I'm trying to remember where that was now, but it was Arizona or somewhere, so I'm not telling a very good story. But anyway, he went out there. And, of course, he was a Michigan boy and was used to the brutal winters, and he really liked it out there. And he started, apparently, musing, supposing I didn't go back this year, but he did, and he practiced, and on the night before the day before the first qualifying day, he announced that he was retiring, and it was kind of stunning, really, because it just seemed to come out of nowhere, but in fact, he actually came on this program that evening, on the Friday evening, and to say that he was done. And I said, you might rethink this. And he said, no, I'm happy with the decision, and I'm done. Well, he soon regretted it. But anyway, so he did not run in the race. And they hired Don Whittington to qualify the car. And then Gordy was a driver expert, along with Roger Ward, for the race. Well, during the winter, he rethought it and decided he wanted to come back, he assumed Patrick would take him back, but they said no, we're not going to be doing it with Gordy anymore. But it was a glorious time, and he had the win in 74. I'm sorry, the win in 73. He was fourth in 74, early out in 75, third in a rain-shortened race in 76, and then third again in 78 when they had North American Van Line sponsorship. And then STP came back into it after they had North American for a few years. Fourth in 80, and then dropped out late, running second in 81. The famous race there where actually Mario, and I shouldn't even be dragging this one up, it's the Bobby Unser Mario situation from 91 that won't go away. Well, right before the end, John Cox was actually running second between Bobby Unser and Mario. But anyway, 82, then he came back to win that fabulous race with Rick Mears, and rather go into all the details on that one now. It was just a fabulous finish, and so it occurred to me then that he went from winning the race that nobody wanted to remember to the one that nobody could ever forget. But they were a great team, Big Noddy and Patrick and Gordy. And Gordy doesn't come back anymore, but it's few and far between. He owns a sawmill, and he works every day. He says, I'm 24/7. He watches the races on TV, but he doesn't like foreign drivers, and he's just a real down-to-earth guy. I think a lot of people didn't understand Gordy. It was really a very good person, and he came across as a little gruff to the fans, I think, or at least at first. But he would always he would visit the Art Pollard or LaRue Carter Children's Hospital, and Pollard would take drivers. And then after Pollard was no longer living, they would try to round up drivers to go. And sometimes it became hard, but Gordy always went, and I know he really did care about kids.
All right, Stephen in Indianapolis, thanks so much for the call. 239-1070, 317-239-1070. Taking your calls of a nostalgic nature here on the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Tony Donahue and Donald Davidson live from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. I want to get to a Twitter question real quick that came in today. If you don't mind, can Donald give a brief history on the BorgWarner Trophy? Yeah. Also with that, did they present something else before 1936? How did BorgWarner get their name on it? And does BorgWarner have connections with it today?
Okay, the latter answer is yes. I did a disservice to Gordy in the last piece. In 1977, it looked like he was going to win the race. And he had a mechanical problem late in the event leading, and that allowed A.J. Foyt, who was a very good friend of his, to go ahead and win for the fourth time. All right, yeah, the BorgWarner Trophy was unveiled in February of 1936, commissioned in 1935. There was, and I'm a little confused on how this came about, and the answer, that in no particular order, was there a permanent award before that permanent trophy? No, there was not. The award with the longest tenure was the Al Strauss Award, and that was given to the winner, and it was something different every year. It was a piece of art. Sometimes it was commissioned, but Strauss would go to Europe, and I keep thinking of Orson Welles in Citizen Kane at the opening scenes there with a very young Alan Ladd, which has got nothing to do with what we're talking about here. But all of the artwork in crates, and I'm not suggesting that Strauss did that, but they would go to Europe for, you know, 2 or 3 months and travel around, and they would see artwork that appealed to them, they wanted for themselves, and once in a while he would see something and thought that would make a great piece for the award, because it would be birds in flight. There's a lady running with either a whippet or a greyhound. I don't have the knowledge to tell the difference, but something that represented speed. And so anyway, that went all the way up and actually continued after the BorgWarner Trophy came in. But there was a business deal that was made that four companies all came together, and BorgWarner was one of the companies. And so I think shortly after that came together, which was like 1931 or 32 or something, and then they started looking to see, well, there's not a permanent annual award that's given to the 500 winner. And so they created this thing, and when it was unveiled, it had a bas-relief sculpture of every 500 winner up to that time. And thus it continues on, and the same sculptor for a number of years would put the new sculpture on, and until the thing finally filled up in 1986, by which time the original sculptor was not only no longer doing it, but I don't think was living anymore. But he did do he continued to do it after it was unveiled for quite a few years. And so as far as the history of it is, it filled up in 86. And what did that mean, that BorgWarner could now, you know, gracefully get out of giving the award? But no, they wanted to keep doing it. So they created a base, and then the base filled up. And I think that was 2004. Now there's a new base on there. All of the bas-relief sculptures that were on the first base were then transferred to the one that's there now. And I think that will take us up through 2034. Mm. And I'm not sure, wow. Was there other points? Because I know there were several things to cover here. Oh, yes, and that was an email question. Yep.
And they are still the presenting sponsor. We know Steve Shunk is on board at that. He does a great job of promoting that.
Absolutely. And when there's a sculpture for each year. Now, I don't know about some of the earlier ones, but I know that, like, Al Unser, They don't say, oh, Allison won again? Oh, let's get the Unser mold out. It's a different one for every year. So it's two different Ari Leyendijks and four different Foyts and four different Rick Mears. And all right, were there other parts to that question?
That was it, because they are still on board. So I will say this, a shameless plug. The 1070 The Fan is having an awesome event on the Circle on Monday from 11 to 1 where you can get your picture with the BorgWarner trophy outside of our building. And Dan Weldon and I had a joke in the summer of 2011 that he is the only person on the BorgWarner with two different sets of teeth.
I remember. You know what? I just my personal little editorial comment. I was sorry when he did that. I liked the original Dan Weldon teeth, and the new set never looked quite right. And I think was his wife or a relative somehow was in the dental business somewhere and had him do it. And I thought, oh, Dan, why didn't you leave it the way it was?
So he was definitely a handsome lad. All right, back to the phone lines we go. Let's go to Chris, who is in Indianapolis. Chris, welcome to the program. You're on with Donald Davidson.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm a longtime listener and first-time caller. Had the opportunity to meet a race car driver named Danny Kladas.
Yes.
A few years ago at an event up in Auburn. And Donald, I was wondering if you could talk about Danny Kladas and anything you may remember about him, and I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Absolutely. Yeah, Danny Kladas was from Iowa originally, although lived in Chicago for most of his life. And he was a midget car driver. I think that was his forte. But as far as Indianapolis, he's a historical footnote because he was the Granatelli brothers' first driver in 1946. Andy and his brothers, Andy had an older brother named Joe and a younger brother named Vince. And not to be confused with Vince, who is is Andy's son. Anyway, the Granatelli brothers had one of the 1935 Ford V8 Millers, and they had a stock block Mercury engine in it with Granker heads. The Granatellis were in the hot rod business, and Granker was actually their company name for Granatelli Corporation. Anyway, so Danny Kladas was the driver, and this sounds like a made-up story, but the car actually was transported from Chicago down to Indianapolis by driving it down. They just put license plates and a tool chest in the riding mechanic seat and street legal, and they drove it down. Anyway, Danny Kladas qualified. I think he started 33rd. And may have been the 33rd fastest qualifier. I think that's right. So, in other words, he survived the bumping, which was the old system then. And he dropped out and finished 21st. But the story is that he came in to make the pit stop at, I'm guessing this is like 80, 85 laps or so. And when he took off, he went around to the second turn and stopped. And what happened was that there was a fuel switch. You had to turn the switch off while the thing was being fueled, and he forgot to turn it back on. And I'm not a technical guy, as I've said on many times in the past, but apparently the fact that he was able to take off and get around to turn two was the fuel in the line. And so the Granatellis went over there, or Andy at least went over there, and I think he figured out what had happened. And I'm not sure where he figured that out in turn two. Or they got the thing fired up, I think, and then drove it through the infield. Well, that constituted the fact that it had left the course, so it was out of the race anyway. But according to Andy in his book, and you have to take some of that with a grain of salt. They call me Mr. 500. He says that he drove it through the infield and back into the gasoline alley right up to the pit gate and sat there and revved the engine up several times so that the people could hear that it was running. Anyway, Danny Kladas came back with them the next year and did not earn a starting position. They only had 30 cars met the requirements that year for a variety of reasons. It was the 33 fastest qualifiers, but they had a minimum qualifying speed, which I think was 115 miles an hour. And Danny Kladis, I think, qualified at like 112. So he completed the four-lap run. They had only 30 starters, and although he was would have been included, he had not met the minimum. So he was back every year with a car. Back then, when all you had to do was show up and present yourself, it wasn't a sponsorship situation. He was there in 1949 with a car called the Speedway Cocktail Special, and that was a potent additive, and whether or not it worked, but it was a short-lived product. In 1950, he made a qualifying attempt with the Federal Engineering Detroit Special, waved off. He also went out with the Ross Page Special, but didn't take the green flag to start an attempt. In 51, he was in one of the 1938 Gulf Miller rear engine cars, which was now had been converted to front drive only. The Trainer Auto Parts Special, he went out on the last day to make a qualifying run, and there was a mechanical problem before he was able to take the green flag. In 52, he was in a car called the Tuffinelli and DiRico Special. George Tuffinelli and Jimmy DiRico from Chicago. And if you're drawing any conclusions about those two names, you're correct. Yes, they were. And anyway, Danny didn't make it with that one. In 1954, he drove in the race as a relief driver, Spider Webb, with the Advanced Muffler Special. And Advanced Mufflers, there was about 40 of those stores in the Los Angeles area. Anyway, it was a very hot day, and Danny Kladis was standing by, and relief drivers were jumping in and out of the cars. He drove a few laps for Spiderweb and then dropped out. 1955, he made a qualifying attempt with the McKay Special. 56. He was in the Commercial Motor Freight Special. Then finally in 1957 with the Morgan Engineering Maserati, which was, a 2-liter, not even a 2.5-liter, but a 2-liter Maserati that was many years old. He qualified that with a very woeful speed, which subsequently got bumped. And then finally, there was a car called the Safety Auto Glass Special, except it's not the one that was on the roof. You'll either know what I'm talking about there or don't worry about it. There was a W196 Mercedes-Benz, which had come here after the war as the Don Lee Special, which had been spirited out of Germany through Switzerland and ended up in the United States and purchased by a man who owned radio stations and car dealerships in California named Don Lee. And the car had run in the 47 race with Duke Nalon and 48 with Chet Miller. It was a V12 Mercedes. A man named Joel Thorne purchased the car for $49, butchered it up, took out the V12 Mercedes, and stuck in a six-cylinder Sparks engine, and then left it in a storage space in Indianapolis where it sat for several years, and the rent wasn't paid. And then finally, it was rescued by three or four local businessmen. One of them was Bob Perkins, who owned the Safety Auto Glass company. So they put a Jaguar sports car engine in, which is pretty much of an abomination. And Danny Kladis practiced with that, but didn't make an attempt. So the summary is, he was 21st in 46, qualified below the minimum of 47. Incomplete attempt in 50, went out to qualify but didn't take the flag in 51, drove laps as a relief driver in 54, incomplete attempt in 55, and then qualified but was bumped in 57. Race summaries only, 21st in 46, 30 as a relief in 54. I say this without having gone to double check. The Kroger store in Speedway, store number 500, which is at one time was the biggest store in the state, I think. But anyway, huge Kroger store out in Speedway. They've just put up some graphics on the outside, and I did a double take, and I meant to go back and have a look at it, and I haven't done it yet. There's a huge blow up of a car coming out, and it looks like to make a qualifying attempt, and I think that's Danny Clatis in the number 93. McKay's Bulldog. Anyway, he was a great character. He had a son named George who also drove midgets, but George was a little more reclusive than Danny, who was a very outgoing guy, funny little guy. And he said Andy Granatelli said I was the wonder boy of the Speedway because it was a wonder every time I came by to complete another lap.
You're listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley right here on FM 107.5 and 1070. The fans still room for you at 317-239-1070 live from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We'll be back right after this on FM 107.5 and 1070. The Fan. Welcome back live to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway 4th Floor Media Center, the Talk of Gasoline Alley, right here on FM 107.5 and 1070. The Fan, Tony Donahue and Donald Davidson with you, taking your calls of a nostalgic nature centered around IMS and the Indianapolis 500. Donald, we're having a fun night so far. Let's keep it rolling, and let's go to Jerry in Frankfort, Kentucky, on line number one. Jerry, welcome to the program. You're on with Donald.
Hi, Jerry.
Good. Hi, guys. How you doing tonight?
Good.
My question for you is, could you profile the career of Mac Hellings, a driver in the late 40s, early 50s?
Yes, I would be delighted. Mac Hellings, I don't get that one very often. Mac Hellings was born in North Dakota, but was raised as a West Coaster. Very successful midget car driver, and forever I've said midget driver, but I thought I better specify midget car driver. And in 1947, there was a midget car race that paid a huge purse. It was at the Los Angeles Coliseum.
Wow.
And with a huge field and a massive purse, and he won that. And so was pretty much considered the West Coast champion. His Indianapolis career was relatively brief, 48 through 51. In 48, he came back as part of the Lou Moore team that had finished first and second in 47 with two front drive cars driven by Maury Rose and Bill Holland. And because Bill Holland wanted to go for the national championship and all of the races other than Indianapolis were on dirt, Lou Moore thought we better get a rear-engined dirt car, and they decided for Holland to drive in the 100 miles on dirt. So they decided to enter it for the 500, and Mac Hellings was the assigned driver. Well, for some reason, it just didn't work out. He never went to the qualifying line, and a couple of other people tried the car, and it didn't make it. So in the meantime, there was a Curtis Craft called the Don Lee Special. And if Don Lee's sounding familiar, yes, he's the fellow that owned the Mercedes that we talked about in the Danny Clatis segment. They also had an Alfa Romeo, and then they had this 270 cubic inch Curtis Craft that was brand new. And actually, that's the car that plays quite a part in To Please a Lady, the film that Clark Gable made with Barbara Stanwyck. The car wasn't in the race, but, I'm probably getting ahead of the game a little bit here. So Mac Hellings qualified that car in 1948 and finished fifth. In those days, they weren't doing Rookie of the Year award yet. And then he had a couple of other very good finishes on the championship trail. I think he never won a championship race, but I think he was second a couple of times. And he also drove the Don Lee Special in 49. And then in 50, he drove for George Tufanelli, who I mentioned earlier, and was 13th in the rain in 50, and then was an early out in 1951 with the Tufanelli and DiRico Special, actually, so which was another car that we mentioned with Danny Clatis. Anyway, Mac Hellings went down in a private plane crash later that year. And I'm not sure whether he had been looking at retirement or what, but he had cut back on his racing activities a little bit. And I am jumping around doing all these different thoughts and trying to have them all make sense. But the Donnelly special that he drove in 48 and 49 was actually purchased by Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, MGM, and for use in the film as the Mike Brannan special, that being the character that Clark Gable played. So it's a little confusing because when you're seeing the stock footage, it's the double is Joey Chitwood in the Wolf Motor Company special 77, but in the close-ups, it's the Don Lee special, and it's not always Clark Gable. It's a guy named Bud Rose. His real name was Harry Isley, but he raced as Bud Rose and was not related to Maury Rose, and he bore a very striking resemblance to Clark Gable. In fact, Gable even offered him a job to go, you know, and just be his regular double. And he said, no, I want to drive race cars. Anyway, they're back on to Mack Hellings. He'd been a very successful motorcycle racer before he turned to cars. So he's one of a number of people that did well on bikes before they went to four wheels. Very much the businessman. He had an auto parts business. And there was a logo on the with a fellow with a helmet on and a huge handlebar mustache. Now he had a mustache, but it wasn't that big. But anyway, the air cleaners, and again, being a non-technical person, if you looked at the of sprints, midgets, and the Indianapolis cars, the of the dirt car variety, there were two highly polished chrome discs that sat side by side, not really discs, but I think they two of them screwed on side by side, and they protected the air cleaners, I think. And I probably don't know what I'm talking about, but if those two silver things on the side of the cars, those were actually Mack Hellings products. And so I know he sold motorcycle equipment and other equipment for racing. But anyway, so it was the weekend of the Bay Meadows Championship race in 51 that he went down in this private plane crash with another driver named Bobby Barker, who was very much on the way up and lost his life. I was big on addresses. And going around to see if I could find the house where people used to live. And I don't do this routinely. I'm not a gravesite person. I don't routinely go to see headstones and so on and so forth. But if I've got an address, I'm sometimes motivated to look up. And so when I was out in California for a while and I had that address, and I decided to see if I could go and see where Mack Hellings lived. And I found the house. And I got quite a bit of pleasure out of that. But thank you for asking about him. I one thing I have always wondered, and that is whether Mack was his given name, M-A-C-K, or whether, in fact, that was a nickname. I've never been able to determine that and hope that I would run into somebody that had gone to school with him or something, because I've learned quite a bit about other drivers from people that went to school with them. So if anybody knows a real name for Mack Hellings, and if you want to Google it, go ahead. I've already done that. I need to know somebody that was there that might know the answer to that.
All right, Jerry, down in Frankfort, Kentucky, thanks so much for the call. Donald, we'll do this one quickly if you don't mind. Mike in Indianapolis, I know you like these kind of off-the-wall ones.
Yes.
Mike in Indianapolis has one that I've never heard of, so I'm looking forward to this one. Mike, go ahead. You're on with Donald Davidson.
Good evening, gentlemen. I would like to hear about Tom Beale's Diner. And with that, thank you for your good work, and I'll hang up and just listen.
All right, well, thank you. I just thought of another Mack Hellings, and this is a quick one. There was the Pat Clancy six-wheeler, which had the two wheels in the front and tandem wheels in the back, and it ran only the 500 in 1948 with Billy DeVore, and he finished 12th. A lot of people laughed at the car, but it made the show, and they made it again in 49 with Jackie Holmes. They took it to some dirt track races that year, and Mack Hellings went to Trenton when the Trenton Mile, when it was still dirt, and he was running third on the next to last lap, I think, and then got upside down. That would have been by far the best finish ever by the Pat Clancy six-wheeler, and that's the only time he drove it. Anyway, Tom Beale's Diner, there was a little lunch counter that was in the garage area, and I'm not sure if it was accessible from the other side of the fence for the public or whether it was entirely within the within the garage area, but it had sides on it that they would raise up, and wooden stools, and this was sort of the hangout for the racers to go, and some of the drivers that were a little down on their luck when we had people that were doing it on a wing and a prayer would sometimes would run up a bill with the understanding that if they made the race, then they would pay the thing out of their winnings. And then also there was a couple of years where the winner would actually pay the whole lot. He would, you know, all of a sudden, fellow from meager beginnings would have thousands and thousands of dollars, so he'd pay all the bills. That diner went probably, I think probably 54 or 5 was about the last year that it was there. And I never really thought to go to the extent of looking at photographs to see if I could determine when it actually stopped. But anyway, Tom Beale, I think, had done a lot of other, I mean, he would go to he would do the festivals he'd be on the road and set up and do the a little rolling concession stand, but this one obviously was a permanent facility, and there's a character based on him. There was a film called the Crowd Roars, which was released in 1932. It was shot during the winter of 31, and it was James Cagney and Joan Blondell, and there's a great sequence where several drivers do cameo. They're playing themselves. So Billy Arnold, the 1930 winner, was actually a pretty good actor. And there's Spider Matlock, who was his riding mechanic, who also happened to be a Hollywood stuntman. And then Fred Frame, Harry Hartz, Shorty Cantlin appears. And so several of them had speaking roles. And then there's an inside joke where you go to Tom Beale's Diner, and up on the where the lunch menu would be, there's the odds written on several drivers, except there's a bit of a mistake because they've got Myers, M-E-Y-E-R-S, and it should be singular. And there's a driver sitting with his back to the camera on one of the lunch stools, but wearing the cloth helmet. And I thought, you don't need the cloth helmet on to eat your lunch. But anyway, he's got the helmet on, but you can't see who it is. And he says to Tom, how come you don't have me up there? And he said, how come you got so-and-so up there? And he said, well, because he's got a good car and he's a good driver. And why don't you have me up there? He said, well, when you're good and ready, you'll be up there too. And then the camera angle, it shows it from the side, and it's Louis Schneider. It's kind of an inside joke, but Louis Schneider had won the 500 that May and was the national champion. But anyway, there's several other stories about it. One, I don't know, it just fits in just a little bit. That Floyd Davis, who ended up being the co-winner in 1937, co-winner in 1941, his debut was 1937. And there was a driver named Al Miller, and that's not the driver from the 60s that they called Mr. Clean. This was whose name was actually Al Krulak. There was, before him, there was a driver who really was Al Miller. Anyway, Al Miller had a wooden leg. He'd lost his leg in a motorcycle several years, and so he was one of three drivers who ran in the race that only had one leg.
Wow.
Bill Schindler and Cal Knighty were the others, and they all ran around the same time, but there was never any more than one in the same race, which has got nothing to do with Tom Beale's Diner, except that Floyd Davis was sitting talking with the other drivers when he was new and just sort of trying to get to know everybody. And he told me this. He said Al Miller was sitting there, and he had a penknife, and he was throwing the penknife so that it would stick in the stool next to him. Just routinely would pick it up and just flick it so that the thing would land in the stool. And he said at one point he missed, and it went in his leg. And he said Al Miller pulled the thing out and never stopped talking. And Floyd Davis doesn't realize that he has a wooden leg. And he said, I thought to myself at that time, boy, if they're that tough around here, I don't know if this is the place for me. Anyway, a lot of great stories about Tom Beale Steiner, and thank you. I don't know that we've had that one before.
The Talk of Gasoline Alley rolls on after this on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Welcome back for the final time here live from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson, Tony Donahue. And let's keep rolling right on along here for the final segment, Donald. And let's go to Bloomington and say hello to Ian. Ian, how are you?
Good evening, sir.
Hi.
You made a dental reference to Dan Weldon with two smiles, so to speak,
yes,
on the BorgWarner.
Uh-huh.
Can you hear me, sir?
Yep.
Yes.
Can you confirm or more likely deny a legend that Sterling Moss' father attended Butler University as a dental student and made a qualification attempt or two?
He actually, I don't know that it was Butler. I think it was IU, but I don't know positively. But yes, Sterling Moss's father was here as a dental student and stayed for a couple of years, and actually drove in the race in 1924.
Indeed.
And he drove in the 24 race and was a relief driver in 25. And it's ironic that Sterling Moss, who was offered cars several times in the 50s and early 60s and turned them all down because he wanted to drive British, but was interested in coming to Indianapolis. So Sterling Moss never did a lap at the Indianapolis Speedway, but his father drove in the race. He'd run a little bit, but not to the extent that I think everybody thought. But he was a great personality who had the pleasure of meeting in 1968. Anyway, so in 24, he was going to drive a car called the Schmidt Special, was actually one of the 1923 Mercedes cars that came here. And it wouldn't be correct to say that they were Mercedes-Benz, because there was no such thing as Mercedes-Benz until 1926. But anyway, one of those three cars stayed here, and he helped repair it and thought that was his ride, and somehow or other that went away. Well, he got hooked up with Arthur Chevrolet, who had three Fronty Fords, the Barbara Warnick Fronty Fords, and Barbara Warnick was a Ford dealer on Washington Street, I think, and they had three cars. They were basically dirt track cars that were Ford based and had this Frontenac head, which was something that had been developed by the Chevrolet brothers after they were nothing to do with the Chevrolet Motor Company anymore. I don't know if any of this makes sense or not. Anyway, the three cars ran all day. One of them had finished fifth in 1923 with LL Corum, but finished the 500 miles, I think, like 30 minutes behind the winner, but it was a very popular finish. So in 24, they had three of them. And they were all running at the end, but back away, including Moss, A.E. Moss, who was Alfred Moss. And he was flagged off in 17th place. The next year, he drove some relief relief laps for a young fellow named Herb Jones with the Jones and Whittaker special, and Jones and Whittaker was another car dealership. Anyway, then tuition was done, so he went back to England. Well, in 1968, he came over for the old-timers barbecue and the race, and a great British gentleman in a suit and tie and wearing a British Racing Drivers Club logo in his lapel. And I got to meet him, and what a delight he was. Just a great, great gentleman. And but he had this very, very, it wasn't an aristocrat accent. It was very, very London. And I remember that after we had talked a little bit, he says I was sitting just down from him at the barbecue on these, you know, long tables. He was about three or four down, and he said to me, or he said to somebody next to him, he knows all the drivers. and then he leaned over to me and he said, I'm trying to remember who were the other drivers on the team. And I said, oh, it was Bill Hunt and Fred Harder. And he said, Fred Harder. And anyway, so I know that's not much of a conversation, but it was just a great, great personality. And so when I eventually met Stirling Moss, it was great to talk to him about his dad.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for asking that.
Yep. Great conversation there. Thanks so much, Ian. If we did not get to you tonight, Tony, Eric, and Paul and Racine, give us a call back on Monday. We'll return right here on FM 107.5 and 1070. The Fan, don't forget tomorrow right here on The Fan. Pre-race show starts at 12 o'clock with myself and JMV. The poll winner, Felix Rosenquist, will join us just around 2 o'clock live from Pagoda Plaza. That'll take you up to the pre-race show with the IMS Radio Network. Donald, you'll be a part of that.
Yes, indeed.
And then he will be right back here with us tomorrow post-race right here on FM 107.5 and 1070. The Fan following the race will take you up till the 7 o'clock hour. Don't forget, over on 93 WIBC, you can check out Indiana Sports Talk with Bob Lovell coming up following us here on The Fan. Is game number 6 down in Houston between the Warriors and Rockets. Donald, thanks for being here tonight.
Thank you, Tony. I love the show.
Yep.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here. We have a lot of fun. We'll be back at it on Monday all next week. Monday night, we'll be back in studio in Emmis, but Tuesday through Friday of next week, when it really gets going on the Oval, we'll have you covered right here in the Talk of Gasoline Alley all next week from 8 until 9 o'clock. Appreciate everybody joining us here for Brad Huber, Donald Davidson, and Tony Donahue. You're listening to FM 107.5 and 1070, The Fan. The Talk of Gasoline Alley returns coming up on Monday night. We'll be back right after this, or we'll be back on Monday. Take care.